This is Dr. Dave Mathewson in his lecture series on New Testament theology. This is session number 18 on the New Exodus, part 1.
In the next couple of sections, what I want to look at is the biblical theological theme and New Testament theological theme of New Exodus or Second Exodus. Usually you'll see that terminology, but referring to the same thing. Sometimes Second Exodus could imply more than one or more than two, but New Exodus and Second Exodus both capture a very important and significant theological theme that we find developed in the New Testament, which also has Old Testament roots. What I want to do then is begin by looking at, very briefly, the Exodus motif in the Old Testament, and we'll look at the Exodus motif as far as the original Exodus out of Egypt, and how that was, very briefly, how that was developed, but then how that became a model or a pattern for a second or a new Exodus already in the Old Testament, and then we'll see how that provides the backdrop for the New Testament's understanding of Jesus coming to accomplish a new Exodus on behalf of the people of God. Now, the theme of New Exodus or Second Exodus could be discussed under the theme of salvation and redemption, themes that we will talk about and cover later on. But I've chosen to cover it here because it also has connections with a number of themes we've discussed already. It has close connections with the land, the very reason God brought Israel out of Egypt, or one of the reasons was to bring them to the land that God had promised to Abraham and the patriarchs, starting with Genesis 12. The theme of New Exodus is related to the people of God. It has to do with Israel as God's son, and his people that God will now redeem and deliver. It has to do with the theme of covenant. God rescues his people based on the covenant he made with Abraham to bring them to the land, based on his relationship with his people, that they are his sons. God will deliver his people and establish a covenant relationship. It's related to the theme of kingdom of God. It's related to the theme of temple, because God, by rescuing his people out of Egypt, intend to bring them into a relationship with him where he will dwell with them, where he will set his sanctuary in their midst. So New Exodus is, and Exodus is related to a number of these themes. So I've chosen to discuss it here in relationship to some of those other themes that we've looked at and developed. Again, I only want to talk briefly about the Exodus, as I said, the original Exodus from Egypt, and then we'll look at the prophetic promises of a new Exodus. But the Exodus should be understood as a crucial foundational event in Israel's history. But to understand the Exodus event, I think it's important to back up, as we've seen with everything that we've discussed, back up all the way to the original creation account, and that is the story of Adam and Eve. We saw how Adam and Eve were created as God's people, as his image bearers, and placed in the on creation, the creation land, Garden of Eden, and they were to, as God's image bearers, to respond in obedience to God, but to spread God's presence, his rule over all of creation, to be God's representatives. But we saw, because of human sinfulness, because Adam and Eve's disobedience and rebellion against God, their creator, they are exiled from the garden, they are exiled from the land and from God's presence. And this then raises the question, how is God going to restore them into a relationship with himself, to be his people, to accomplish his purpose? But how is he also going to bring them back to the land, back to the gracious gift of the land that God had given them, where God would dwell in their midst? How is God going to do that? And we saw with Genesis chapter 12, God calls Abraham, and through God's electing choice, through God's choice, he chooses Abraham to begin to work to restore his intention for creation and for humanity. Through Abraham, God will bring about a great nation, and eventually all the nations of the earth would be blessed. Yet, we saw that if you follow the storyline, by the time you get to the end of Genesis, Israel ends up, in a sense, in exile, or at least they end up in a foreign country in Egypt, where they are in bondage and servitude to the Egyptians. And the question still then remains, how is God going to bring them to the land that he promised Abraham? How is God going to restore his people to a relationship with himself, enter into a covenant relationship, dwell in their midst in the land that he had promised them? This then brings us to the Exodus event. The Exodus is the event where God delivers and rescues his people from Egypt, from the oppression and servitude of a foreign nation. And God's deliverance of the of Israel from the Egyptians climaxes then with his covenant relationship with his people. Again, he will be their God. They will be his people. Exodus chapter 4, Israel is the nation of Israel, is God's son. And God then intends to rescue them and enter into a covenant relationship with his people and to establish his sanctuary and dwelling in their midst. So notice verse 17 and 18 of Exodus 15. After Moses leads the Israelites out of Egypt, across the Red Sea, and begin their trek through the wilderness. After he gets across the Red Sea, we read in Exodus 15 of the song that Moses sings, and it ends with this reference in 17 and 18 that we've read in connection with temple and people of God. You will bring them, that is the nation of Israel, you will bring them and plant them, interestingly notice the Garden of Eden language, on the mountain of your inheritance, the place the Lord will make for your dwelling, the sanctuary, Lord, your hands established. The Lord reigns forever and ever. So the goal of the Exodus is that God would dwell in their midst, God would establish his dwelling, his sanctuary, and God would reign forever. So, as we said, Exodus is related to those themes, or themes of temple, themes of kingdom of God, and God reigning over his people. Now, when we look at the account in Genesis of the Exodus event, Genesis begins with the calling of Moses as God's chosen deliverer. It's through Moses that God will rescue his people in fulfillment of his covenant with Abraham, in fulfillment of his intention for his people in Genesis 1 and 2. God now will rescue his people, and Moses is his chosen servant to do that. But as we read the account of the Exodus, before God leads his people, and I want to highlight just a handful of themes just because they will become significant, especially for how we see this theme getting developed in the rest of the Old Testament, but into the New Testament as well. As you may recall, the Exodus account is preceded by 10 plagues that God brings upon Egypt, and while preserving Israel from these plagues, you recall just very quickly plagues such as darkness upon the land and frogs and the well-known turning of the water blood red and the gnats and the locust and the sores and the land becoming dark. Those 10 plagues, a couple things. Number one, are probably clearly to be seen as judgments upon the gods of Egypt. So each of those plagues are attacks on not just the Egyptians themselves, but on their gods. So it's as if their gods have run amok. Their gods are out of control. Their gods can do nothing. But second, we should probably understand these plagues as sort of a decreation theme. That, interestingly, one of the intertestamental works, the Wisdom, a book entitled Wisdom, actually describes the Exodus as a sort of a creation, a recreation of things, as it were. And so we should probably see the 10 plagues as kind of a decreation, a judgment on the former creation, on the land and the gods who rule over it. in preparation for the creation of a new people, in preparation for the rescuing and delivering of the people from the hands of Egypt. So the 10 plagues play a crucial role in bringing judgment upon the gods of Egypt and the land, sort of a decreation motif in preparation for God's exodus. A second thing to draw attention to is the exodus should be seen as a redemption, and that is God is redeeming, God is freeing or liberating his people from foreign oppression. And this will become an important model, this will become an important background for the concept of redemption elsewhere in the Old Testament. And when into the New Testament, we'll look more specifically at the theme of redemption when we deal with the biblical theological New Testament theme of salvation. But we'll mention it several times in the course of this discussion in connection with the Exodus. So the Exodus is to be seen as redemption, a freeing, a liberating of the people of God from bondage. So the people are understood as in bondage, under oppression, and that the Exodus then is a liberation or a redemption, a freeing of the people from their situation in bondage, particularly here, a bondage to a foreign oppressor and a foreign ruler. So keep in mind that theme of the Exodus as a redemption and a freeing of the people. Now, there's all kinds of other things we could say about the Exodus, but I'm primarily interested in those motifs that will get developed in the New Testament. The last thing then to say about the Exodus is the Exodus signifies and in a sense is the climax of God's mighty and powerful acts in history. So we've talked before about the fact that biblical theology is clearly rooted in history. It's not simply literary, but biblical theology is rooted in God's historical acts, his redemptive historical acts on part of his people. And this is one of the most crucial examples of God invading history to rescue and liberate his people in the context of history as being oppressed by a foreign nation, and God, remembering his covenant with his people, intervenes in history to graciously take the initiative to demonstrate his mighty power by rescuing his people. And by the way, as sort of an aside, we haven't dealt exclusively, nor will we exclusively, with the theme of God as a biblical theological theme, but hopefully you've realized that the theme of God underlies virtually everything we've said. When we discuss themes like kingdom of God or the covenant God makes with his people, everything that we've talked about assumes God's existence, it assumes God's initiative, his gracious acts, his power, his kingship, his lordship, his creative initiative and power, his intent to dwell with his people. Everything we look at assumes that underlying it is God himself. And so here we see God acting in history and taking the initiative to demonstrate his mighty power by rescuing and intervening to deliver his people from suffering and oppression. And so because of this, the Exodus becomes probably the foundational identifying act of the people of God. It becomes that act which becomes foundational for their identity as the people of God and for who they are. What demonstrates this very clearly, I think, is then the Exodus. After reading the historical account of the Exodus and God acting to redeem his people, intervening in history, throughout the rest of the Old Testament, we find the Exodus becoming a paradigm for God's acting on behalf of his people, for God's mighty deliverance of his people. And we often find commands throughout the Old Testament that the Exodus is to be remembered repeatedly. And also that it often becomes foundational for other acts of God, or it becomes foundational for the response of the people. So, for example, a few chapters later, after Exodus 15 and the Song of Moses, a few chapters later, we find that God now will, after leading the people through the Red Sea and their trek through the wilderness, God now begins to, through establishing his covenant relationship through Moses, what we often call the Mosaic Covenant or the Old Covenant, according to the book of Hebrews. In chapter 20, as God now will begin to provide his commands for his people to follow and the stipulations of his covenant relationship, chapter 20 of Exodus is the well-known section containing the Ten Commandments of the Decalogue, which kind of forms the basis for God's commands to his people. But notice verses 1 and 2. And God spoke all these words, that'll be the rest of chapter 20, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. And then what happens next will be the Ten Commandments. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make yourselves an image. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God. Remember the Sabbath, etc., etc. Now, what is significant about this is before God issues commands to his people, he bases that on his gracious act of deliverance at the Exodus. So God is not calling upon his people to somehow perform before him and in some sense earn his and merit his favor, but bases his commands on his prior gracious act of deliverance. But the main point is the Exodus then forms the basis for the commands that now God gives his people as he enters into a covenant relationship with them. Another text, again, simply demonstrating the significance that the Exodus event was to have for the people of God. In 1 Kings chapter 8, 1 Kings 8 and verse 51, again, I'm just giving a sampling of text. 1 Kings 8 and 51, I'll back up and read 50. And forgive your people who have sinned against you, forgive all the offenses they have committed against you, and cause their captors to show them mercy, for they are your people and your inheritance, whom you brought out of Egypt, out of that iron-smelting furnace. So the Solomon's call for God to forgive his people is based on the fact that they are his people whom he has led out of Egypt from bondage. Deuteronomy chapter 26 and verse 8. Deuteronomy chapter 26 and verse 8. Back up and read verse 6. But the Egyptians mistreated us and made us suffer, subjecting us to harsh labor. Then we cried out to the Lord, the God of our ancestors, and the Lord heard our voice and saw our misery, toil, and oppression. So the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, with great terror and with signs and wonders. And then verse 9, he brought us to this place and gave us this land, a land flowing of milk and honey. So again, the Exodus is to be remembered as sort of the foundational event that leads, then climaxes to God bringing them to the land he promised them, to Abraham, Genesis 12, where God then sets up his sanctuary to dwell in their midst. If I can just mention a number of other texts, the Psalms are littered with examples of the Exodus as the foundational event of the life of God's people and a demonstration of God's mighty power in delivering the people of God. And so again, this is something they were to look back on and remember. So Psalm chapter 77, 77 and verse 11, I will remember the deeds of the Lord. Yes, I will remember your miracles from long ago. And down to verse 14, 15, and 16. You are the God who performs miracles. You display your power among the people. With your mighty arm, you redeem your people, the descendants of Jacob and Joseph. A reference to the Exodus, and notice the language of redemption. The waters saw you, the Red Sea. God, the waters saw you and writhed. The very depths were convulsed. Again, the Psalms demonstrating God's mighty power in the Exodus. Verse 19 of the same Psalm. Your path led through the sea, your way through the mighty waters, though your footprints were not seen. And then verse 20, you led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. Chapter 78, the very next one, 78 and 12 and 13. He did miracles in the sight of their ancestors in the land of Egypt, in the region of Zoan. He divided the sea and led them through. He made the water stand up like a wall. And then he guided them with a cloud by day and with light from the fire all night. So a psalm that is recounting God's mighty deeds and acts on behalf of his people. And many of these psalms are often a list, kind of a survey of the Old Testament, a list of reminders of how God has acted on behalf of his people. And usually you find in them a reference to the Exodus. Psalm 66, Psalm 66 and verses 5 and 6. Come and see what God has done, his awesome deeds for mankind. And here's one. He turned the sea into dry land. They passed through the waters on foot. Come, let us rejoice in him. And notice in most of these psalms the drying of the up of the sea so the people can cross over becomes a key feature of the description of the Exodus. We'll see that becomes important for when we start to look at the new or the second Exodus later on. And then finally, one more in the Psalms, Psalm 105 and verses 23 through and following. Starting with verse 23, then Israel, again, this is a psalm of God who is to be praised because he's remembered his covenant with his people, and he's to be praised because of his wonderful acts. They're to tell people, sing praise, and tell of his wonderful acts. Psalm 105, verse 2. And then starting at verse 23, then Israel entered Egypt. Jacob resided as a foreigner in the land of Ham. The Lord made his people fruitful. He made them too numerous for their foes. Notice the link back to Genesis 1, 26 and 27. Whose hearts he turned to hate his people, to conspire against his servants. He sent Moses, his servant, and Aaron, whom he had chosen. They performed signs among them, his wonders in the hand of Ham. He sent darkness and made the land dark, for had they not rebelled against his words. He turned their water into blood, causing their fish to die, their land teemed with frogs. Notice all the references to the plagues. And then, I'll skip down to verse 36. Then he struck down all their firstborn of the land, their first fruit of their manhood. He brought out Israel laden with silver and gold, and from among their tribes no one faltered. Egypt was glad when they left, because the dread of Israel had fallen upon them. So notice the length of in this psalm, the length of space devoted to the Exodus. But if we can move on to one more section, just give a couple of examples, because this will prepare for looking at the Old Testament development of the New Exodus, is also we find prophetic text surveying or recalling the Exodus as a foundational event, as God's mighty act on behalf of his people. So Jeremiah chapter 32, Jeremiah chapter 32 and verse 21. And this is in the context of a prayer of Jeremiah. And verse 21, I'll back up and read verse 20. You perform signs and wonders in Egypt. a reference to the plagues, and have continued them to this day in Israel among all mankind, and have gained the renown that is still yours. You brought your people Israel out of Egypt with signs and wonders by the mighty hand and an outstretched arm with great terror. Isaiah chapter 11, not only Jeremiah, but Isaiah chapter 11, which we'll see. The book of Isaiah is probably the most significant book when it comes to developing the theme of a new Exodus or a second Exodus, which we'll talk about in just a moment. But chapter 11 and verses 15 and 16, the Lord will dry up the gulf of the Egyptian sea. With a scorching wind, he will sweep his hand over the Euphrates River. He will break it up into seven streams, so that anyone can cross over in sandals. There will be a highway for the remnant of his people that is left from Assyria. And there, as there was for Israel when they came out of, from Egypt. So notice already in Isaiah 11, we start to see the first Exodus when he says, as there was for Israel when they came up from Egypt, as a model for how God is going to act again for his people. One other one would be Hosea chapter 11, verse 1, out of Egypt I called my son. Again, that's in the context. We'll look at that verse in a little more detail in connection with its use in the book of Matthew. But in Hosea 11, we find in that surrounding section, again, God, the prophet recalling what God has done on behalf of his people. And Israel, as God's son, now was rescued or delivered from Egypt. So clearly, and we could look at numerous other texts, I've just tried to sample some of them, but from later history, from the Psalms and into the prophetic text, we find the Exodus plays a crucial foundational role for God redeeming it and saving his people. God acting with his might and power, his outstretched arm, to rescue his people from slavery and oppression and to bring them into a covenant relationship with himself. Now, as I've noted, these, especially the prophetic texts, but I would suggest all of these texts I've looked at, this notion of the Exodus becoming a paradigm of how God, of God's mighty acts on behalf of his people, kind of the foundational event of the identity of Israel as the people of God, whom he delivered and rescued, becomes a model or pattern for prophetic expectations of a new or greater Exodus. So that one of the things we find in the prophets is that one of the most characteristic ways that God's future deliverance of his people is described is as a second or a new or a greater Exodus, modeled after the first one. So in it's almost to be understood in the language of typology or analogy, in the same way that God rescued and delivered his people Israel from oppression and bondage, once more God will deliver and rescue his people from oppression and bondage again, that is in exile. So the prophets are addressing Israel as about to go into exile or in exile, and now conceives of that exile. Remember when the northern nation of Israel goes off into exile, the southern nation Judah a little bit later goes off into exile, and that period of exile is seen as one of oppression or suffering. And God then, intending to redeem and rescue his people once more, just as he did in the first Exodus. And I would suggest that the connection is probably more than just an analogy or similarity, or the first Exodus kind of provides an analogy for what's going to happen again. But the first Exodus actually becomes typological of how God will deliver his people again. A subsequent time. And so the Exodus becomes, as we saw in the Psalms and even in the historical literature, the Exodus becomes so important that that the prophets now conceive of a future salvation, a future deliverance of God's people from exile in Exodus language and Exodus terms. And probably, although we could go through a number of texts in the prophets, there's hints of this in Jeremiah in several places. Some of the minor prophets, there are hints of this. We probably find this in Ezekiel, even in that section, chapter 36, all through 48. That movement of rescuing the people, establishing a covenant relationship with them, bringing them back to the land, and God establishing his dwelling in their midst, which is described in 40 through 48, that pattern is an Exodus pattern of restoration, creation, deliverance, restoration and creation, and then giving them the land and establishing God's dwelling. That's the pattern established in the Exodus. Climaxing in Exodus 15 in the Song of Moses, the section we just read earlier. But probably the Old Testament prophetic text that describes the return from exile, the salvation and rescuing of God's people from oppression in exile, more than any other prophet is the book of Isaiah, and especially chapters 40 through 55. And there's been a lot of work in the form of articles and sections of books and books that have addressed the issue of Isaiah's use of the Exodus, or Isaiah's new Exodus motif, or new Exodus theme. And we'll see that Isaiah's new Exodus theme becomes crucial for understanding several texts in the New Testament that develop the Exodus motif. But Isaiah 40 through 55, who again is Isaiah 40 through 55 addressing the situation of Israel when they're in exile, over and over again conceives of their return from exile, God's deliverance, intervention, and deliverance of his people from exile, in fulfillment of the promises made to Abraham and his intention to bring them back to the land, conceives of that in Exodus terms. Once more, we don't have time to look at all the texts, but I want to look at some of them just once again because it's important to be able to begin to formulate Isaiah's understanding of the deliverance of God's people as a new Exodus, especially in preparation for the New Testament use of this motif. And a number of these texts I'm going to read and just comment on very briefly are actually texts that we'll see come up a couple of times in the New Testament itself. The starting point would be chapter 40 and verses 3 through 5. Isaiah chapter 40, verses 3 through 5. Comfort, comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and proclaim to her that her hard service has been completed, that her sins have been paid for, that she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. A voice of one calling, in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord. Make straight in the deserts a highway for our God. Every valley will be raised up, every mountain and hill made low. The rough ground shall become level, the rugged places a plain, and the glory of the Lord will be revealed, and all people will see it together, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. And that's a text that becomes important in the New Testament, but a text that resonates with a number of Exodus themes and portrays the return of the people from exile back to their land as a new Exodus. Again, in fulfillment of the original Exodus where God brought his people out of bondage to Egypt. Just skipping through a number of sections, chapter 42 and 15 through 16. I will lay waste the mountains and hills, and I will dry up all their vegetation. I will turn rivers into islands and dry up the pools. I will lead the blind by the way they have not known. Along unfamiliar paths I will guide them. I will turn darkness into light before them and make the rough places smooth. These are the things I will do. I will not forsake them. And notice that language of drying up rivers, drying up pools. Again, making a way for them to cross over and come into their land, referring to the Israelites then coming back to their land after exile in a foreign country under bondage in exile. 43, even more clear, chapter 43 and 16 through 19. This is what the Lord says. Again, he's describing a day when God is going to intervene on behalf of his people, bring them out of exile back to their land. This is what the Lord says. He who made a way through the sea, a path through the mighty waters, a reference to the original Exodus event when God parted the Red Sea and the people crossed over into dry land. Verse 17, who drew out the chariots and horses, the army and reinforcements together, and they lay there, never to rise again, extinguished, snuffed out like a wick, a reference to the destruction of Pharaoh's army. But then the author goes on and says, forget the former things, do not dwell on them. See, I am doing a new thing. Now it springs up. Do you not perceive it? I am making a way in the wilderness and streams in the wasteland. Now notice again, it's the author calls on them to, interestingly, after calling all these accounts elsewhere in the Old Testament to remember the Exodus, to recall it, now the author says, forget those things, now I'm doing a new thing. Again, I don't think the idea is they should put that out of their mind and never think of it or remember it again, but the author's contrasting the greatness of this new Exodus, where the first one will pale in comparison. God's about to do something even greater. God's about to enact a new Exodus that's even greater than that one where he led the people out of Egypt and through the Red Sea and extinguished Pharaoh's army. And then one more, chapter 51, we could look at all kinds of other ones, but chapter 51 and 9 through 11, again in the context of God rescuing and redeeming and restoring his people back to the land out of exile, he says, awake, awake, arm of the Lord. Notice some of those verses we read in Psalms and elsewhere that referred to the outstretched arm of God, the mighty arm of God. Awake, awake, arm of the Lord. Clothe yourself with strength. Awake as in the days gone by, as in generations of old. What days does he have in mind? What generations? Was it not you who cut Rahab to pieces, who pierced that monster through? Was it not you who dried up the sea, the waters of the great deep, who made a road in the depths of the sea so that the redeemed might cross over? Those the Lord has rescued will return. They will enter Zion with singing. Everlasting joy will crown their heads. Gladness and joy will overtake them, and sorrow and sighing will flee away. So notice again the comparison between the author is basically asking God to awaken his arm and his strength, the same arm and strength that delivered the people from the first Exodus. Now he calls on to act again, to deliver his people in a new Exodus, modeled after the first one, where again God will bring his people, he'll dry the sea, the metaphorical sea that threatens God's people. Notice the connection with Rahab, sort of a symbolic monster of evil. It's interesting, the Targum of Isaiah, the Aramaic paraphrase of Isaiah 51, actually calls Rahab. Rahab, again, was kind of a dragon, beast, serpent-type figure, a beastly figure that was emblematic of evil and chaos. It was a monster of the sea. The Isaiah Targum calls Rahab Pharaoh. And so the sea was seen as that which was threatening and harmful. It was a barrier to God's people escaping evil and oppression and death and crossing over into their land where there was rejoicing and gladness and joy. And now, the author conceives of a new Exodus where God's mighty arm and strength that rescued them from the first Exodus from Pharaoh and the sea would once again act on behalf of his people. Now, as I said, there are several other texts in Isaiah we could look at and other prophetic texts, but I think these are the most clear and these are the most common examples of the new Exodus in the Old Testament. So the significance of all this, once more, is that God's future deliverance of his people from exile is now patterned after the first Exodus. Because, again, there's probably a typological relationship. God's redemption of his people in the first Exodus stood as a type of an anticipation of a greater act of redemption, a greater exodus, where God will deliver his people from exile in a new act, a new exodus. And he will restore his people to their land in covenant relationship with them. He will be their God. They will be his people. He will dwell in their midst. Now, this also, just briefly, before we move on to the New Testament evidence, to demonstrate how it picks up the Exodus, the original Exodus, but especially this New Testament, or this new Exodus motif, and particularly from Isaiah, the last thing to say is the Exodus motif also fits within the broader theme of sin and exile. So we see that already, starting in the Garden of Eden, the theme of sin leading to exile. And we find, in fact, we find this pattern of creation and then sin and exile and finally restoration. We see that first of all in the Garden of Eden. So God creates, humanity then sins. They are exiled from the garden. And then we find restoration beginning with the nation of Israel by God beginning to recreate, restore a new people of God through Abraham. Yet we've already seen that they fare no better. Israel also sins. They are also exiled from the land. But now God promises in the prophets a restoration of his people. So the significance of exile then is that Israel is in exile in bondage because of their sinfulness, and this also means exclusion from God's presence, breaking of the covenant relationship, and then the deliverance from exile, especially in the Old Testament prophetic text that we looked at, is conceived of as a new exodus. The restoration can be seen as a new creation as well, but the point I want to make is the new exodus is part of this sin, exile, and restoration motif that we see. So just as Israel was in bondage to Egypt, then they are in exile to Egypt, and they are restored from that. We find the Old Testament prophets then conceiving of Israel in exile because of sin and about to be restored in a new Exodus act. So, that brings us then to the New Testament, and I want to proceed by looking at the Gospels, and then we'll look briefly at Acts, and then the Pauline literature, perhaps a couple of other texts outside of Paul, and then we'll end with the book of Revelation and see how it develops the new Exodus motif. So, we'll follow the canonical order. And again, I'm just going to give a sampling of texts, ones that I think are fairly clear or where the new Exodus motif might help illumine the text. There's a lot of other ones we could refer to and notice, but I'll stick with the ones I think are most prominent. So the beginning point for understanding the New Testament development of the Exodus or the new Exodus motif is the Gospels. And I want to begin with Matthew. In my opinion, more than any of the other Gospels, except perhaps Mark, perhaps along with Mark, Matthew and Mark developed the new Exodus motif more than any of the other Gospels. And in fact, when you begin with Matthew chapter 1, you already, we've mentioned this passage before, but in chapter 1 and verse 1, it's as if the author already sets you up to read Matthew as the conclusion of Israel's story, or almost as a kind of, sort of a recapitulation of Israel's story, or at least it's to be read in conjunction with Israel's story. Jesus is the son of David, the son of Abraham. You can't read the rest of Matthew then without having some knowledge of the Old Testament story that Jesus, in Matthew's account, is now going to complete and bring to fulfillment. And what we actually find going on in Matthew chapters 1 and 2 is a number of things going on. I think we find Matthew referring to a number of Old Testament texts. He clearly quotes several, but I think he alludes to several more. But in the midst of all those Old Testament allusions and quotations, and stories that Matthew weaves into his own narrative to describe Jesus and to portray Jesus, is one of those is the Exodus account. And in especially in Matthew chapter 2, Matthew chapter 2, we find Jesus portrayed particularly, I think, both as, and it's interesting what Matthew does, Jesus appears to be sort of a new Moses, even if that's not the dominant theme, as some have sometimes claimed. It's at least one of the themes that Jesus, that Matthew wants to get across, that Jesus functions as a new Moses in chapter 2. So you can't help but see allusions to Moses going all the way back to Matthew chapter 1, where Jesus is, Joseph is told to name the baby Jesus because he will save his people from their sins. So here's the deliverer, who will rescue his people from bondage to sin. And again, whether one agrees with him completely or not, N.T. Wright has been one of the ones who has argued that at least some Israelites, some Jewish writers in the first century understood themselves to still be in exile, and now Jesus is the one who will deliver his people from exile, but an exile far worse than just oppression under a foreign nation, but an exile of bondage to sin. And now Jesus is the one who will rescue his people, who will do what Moses did, and that is now he will save his people from their sins. Now he will deliver them from exile. So already in chapter 1, here's the one who will deliver his people from exile, a Moses-like deliverer or savior. And then in chapter 2, we find Jesus, in a sense, being connected with other Moses imagery, is he is the one who, he's the one that is rescued in the midst of another king, a wicked, oppressive king, Herod, who, much like Pharaoh, decides to destroy all the baby boys 2 years and younger because he wants to make sure he gets Jesus, this new king that Herod sees as a threat to his throne. So this reference to Herod deciding to kill all the baby boys 2 years and younger in Bethlehem and the surrounding regions clearly recalls the same deed of Pharaoh back in the book of Exodus. There's another very interesting reference in chapter 2, in verse 20 of Matthew, and when the angel, after Herod dies, an angel appears to Joseph, verse 20, and says, and notice it says to Joseph in Egypt, and he says, "Get up, take the child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel, for those who were trying to take the child's life are dead." Which is an interesting phrase. That language comes right out of Exodus. Remember when Moses, before coming back to deliver the Egyptians or the Israelites from Egypt, he fled because he'd killed an Israelite and he feared for his life. And these words, those who were trying to take his life are dead, comes right out of the book of Exodus. So the author is alluding to events from the life of Moses to portray Jesus, I think, if not the dominant theme, at least one of the themes, as a new Moses, a Moses-type deliverer who will rescue and save his people. But Jesus also, in a sense, recapitulates Israel's own history. So he's not only portrayed as a Moses, a new Moses, but he is also recapitulating and embodying Israel's own history. So in the same way that Israel goes down to Egypt and then God calls them out of Egypt, we find that as well in verses 12 and following. "When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, 'Get up and take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him.' So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night, and left for Egypt. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had spoken through through the prophet," this is verse 15, "'Out of Egypt I called my son.'" And then later on in verse 19, than Jesus, Mary and Joseph, do take Jesus out of Egypt and to Nazareth. But this movement to Egypt and then out of Egypt is taken as fulfilling an Old Testament text in Matthew chapter 2 and verse 15. So Jesus is seen again as recapitulating or embodying Israel's history of being led out of Egypt. So in chapter 2 of Matthew, it's as if the author, I think, is kind of structuring his account of a new Exodus. Jesus is a Moses-like deliverer who will lead his people out of Egypt. Jesus himself embodies Israel's rescue from Egypt, I think intending to demonstrate what he intends to do for his people. He is now about to not only embody Israel's rescue from Egypt, but to enact a new Exodus, where he will begin to save his people from their sins. He will deliver them from exile in a new Exodus. Let me just stop and say something about that interesting quotation in Matthew 2:15. Out of Egypt I've called my son. That is a direct quote from Hosea chapter 11 and verse 1. The difficulty in Hosea 11 verse 1 is that when you read that text, when you read Hosea 11:1, it's not clear, at least this verse, it's not clear that this is a prophecy or prediction. It seems to just be an account. It seems to just be a description of what God did his people for his people in the first Exodus. It says, "When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son." Verse 2, "But the more they were called, the more they went away from me. They sacrificed to the Baals, and they burned incense to images. It was I who taught Ephraim to walk, taking them by the arms, but they did not realize." So it seems like this is simply a historical description of what God did to his people, yet they rebelled. And the question is, how does and why does Matthew apply this to Jesus Christ? How does this text get applied to Christ when, although it's in a prophetic text, it doesn't seem to be a direct prediction of the coming of Christ? Well, two things. Number one is that it seems to me, especially when you read chapter 4, actually the end of chapter 3, Jesus' baptism, the end of Matthew 3, when Jesus' baptism, and then into chapter 4, 1 through 11, Jesus' temptation. There also it becomes clear that Jesus Christ is the Son. Remember when he's baptized, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am pleased," quoting from the Old Testament, Psalms and Isaiah. Davidic text. "So this is my son." And then in chapter 4, 1 through 11, the son gets tempted. He's led into the wilderness and Satan's first two temptations. If you are the Son of God, if you are truly the Son, then do this. Of course, Jesus resists, as we saw. But the point is, first of all, Matthew has Jesus once more embodying and recapitulating Israel's history. As in the same way that Israel was the son, Exodus 4, 22 and 23, look those up sometime, we've read those before. But in the same way Israel was the son, now Jesus Christ is the greater son who fulfills Israel's purposes and destiny. Therefore, what applies to Israel can apply to Jesus as well. In the sense that Israel was the son, now we find the greater son. But second, I think even more important than that even within the context, of Hosea, if you read a little bit further in 10 and 11 particularly, they will follow the Lord. Actually, let me back up. Verse 9, "I will not carry out my fierce anger, nor will I devastate Ephraim again, for I am God and not a man, the Holy One among you. I will not come against their cities." They will follow the Lord. "He will roar like a lion. When he roars, his children will come trembling from the west. They will come from Egypt, trembling like sparrows, from Assyria, fluttering like doves. I will settle them in their homes, declares the Lord." In other words, verses 10 and 11 of Hosea 11 seem to anticipate a future deliverance and restoration in analogy to God's deliverance from Egypt. So chapter 11 of Hosea itself ends with a reference to a new exodus, a deliverance modeled after the first one. So putting that all together, according to Matthew, it's Jesus who brings about that new exodus. Jesus as the true Son of God, Jesus as the true Son who embodies Israel's purposes and destiny is now going to bring about that new exodus even promised in Hosea chapter 11. So Matthew chapter 1 and 2 particularly, but there's probably some other texts we could point to in Matthew where Jesus is portrayed as a new Moses type figure, but that he brings about a new exodus. He brings about a salvation that is seen as a fulfillment of the new exodus from especially the prophetic literature, but again, repeating or recapitulating the first exodus where God delivered and rescued his people. The Gospel of Mark is probably another book, not just a scattered text here and there, but an entire book, that whether this is the dominant theme or not could be debated, but certainly one of the major themes in Mark is that the salvation that Jesus brings is to be conceived of as a new exodus. And one writer in particular, a professor of New Testament at Regent College in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, has argued that the Gospel of Mark presents Jesus as fulfilling the new exodus of Isaiah 40 through 66. So what he does is he works with the book of Mark, and I won't repeat all that he does, but he works with the book of Mark and demonstrates over and over that key texts and places in Mark are modeled after or are alluding to Isaiah chapter sections and verses from Isaiah 40 through 66, demonstrating that Jesus brings about a new exodus. And the starting point for him, the starting point is at the very beginning of the book that kind of signals how the rest of the book is to be read, and that's Mark chapter 1 and verse 1. The beginning of the good news about Jesus the Messiah, Son of God, as it is written in Isaiah the prophet. And here's one of the texts we read a moment ago that's in the context of a new exodus. I will send my messenger ahead of you, who will prepare your way. A voice of one calling in the wilderness, prepare the way for the Lord, make straight paths for him. An allusion to also to Malachi chapter 3, but Isaiah 40 and verse 3, one of the New Testament texts, or New Exodus texts from Isaiah that we read earlier. So the Gospel of Mark also presents Jesus as fulfilling, bringing about a new exodus, saving and delivering and rescuing his people in a new exodus, in fulfillment of Isaiah's expectation of a new exodus. And in the next segment then, we'll look at a couple of other gospel texts in the Gospels and Acts that probably point to a new exodus event, and then again move into Paul's letters and the rest of the New Testament to see how the new exodus motif gets developed there as well.
This is Dr. Dave Mathewson in his lecture series on New Testament theology. This is session number 18 on the New Exodus, part 1.